And so what did you tell him? He asked her.
I told him that I'd think about it, she said.
And? My father said.
And I've thought about it, she said,
taking my father's bloody hand in her own. They fell into a kiss. On meeting the in-laws. According to my father, my mother's father had no hair anywhere on his body. He owned a farm in the country where he lived with his wife, bedridden by then for 10 years, unable to feed herself or talk, and he rode a great horse, as big as any horse there was, and black, with a spot of white on each of its legs just above the hooves. He adored my mother. He had told amazing stories about her since she was little, and now that he was old and had lost some of his mind, it appeared that he had begun to believe them. He thought she hung the moon. He actually believed this from time to time. He believed the moon wouldn't have been there, but that she'd hung it. He believed the stars were wishes, and that one day they would all come true for her, his daughter. He had told her this when she was little to make her happy, and now that he was old, he believed it, because it made him happy, and because he was so very old. He'd not been invited to the wedding. How this could happen is simple. No one had. It wasn't a wedding as much as it was a legal proceeding at the Auburn courthouse, with strangers as witnesses and a febrile old judge as minister, pronouncing in his drawl, with little bits of white spittle gathering in the corners of his mouth, that from this moment forward you are now man and wife till death do you part, etc. And thus it was done. This wasn't going to be easy to explain to Mr. Templeton, but my father wanted to give it a try. He drove up to the gate of the farm where there was a sign that read, "Stop, blow horn," and by coincidence, there, too, was his new wife's father, atop his horse, much bigger than life, suspiciously eyeing the long car from which his daughter shyly waved. He opened the gate by slipping a piece of wood from a 6-inch-wide slit carved into a fence post, and my father drove slowly so as not to spook the horse. He drove on up to the house, Mr. Templeton following on horseback. My mother and father were quiet. He looked over at her and smiled. "There's nothing to worry about," he said. "Who's worried?" she said, laughing, though neither of them seemed particularly reassured.
"Daddy," she said up at the house, "I want you to meet Edward Bloom." "Edward, Seth Templeton, now y'all shake hands."
They did. Mr. Templeton looked at his daughter.
"Why am I doing this?" he said.
"Doing what?"
"Shaking this man's hand."
"'Cause he's my husband," she said. "We got married, Daddy."
He kept shaking, looking deep into Edward's eyes. Then he laughed. It sounded like the burst from a firecracker.
"Married," he said,
and he walked inside. The newlyweds followed. He brought them a couple of Cokes from the icebox, and they sat down in the living room where Mr. Templeton stuffed an ivory-stemmed pipe full of black tobacco and lit it. And the room was suddenly overcast with a thin layer of smoke, which hung just above their heads.
"So what's this all about?"
he said, sucking away and coughing. It was a question that seemed difficult to answer, so neither of them said anything. They just smiled. Edward stared at the man's hairless, egg-like head, then into his eyes.
"I love your daughter, Mr. Templeton," my father said, "and I'm going to love her and take care of her for the rest of my life."
My father had thought of what he was going to say for a long time, and he'd come up with these simple yet profound words. He thought they said everything that needed saying, and hoped Mr. Templeton would think so too.
"Bloom, you say?"
Mr. Templeton said, squinting.
"Knew a man named Bloom once. Rode with him, 1918, 1919. I was in the cavalry stationed in Yellowstone. In those days, there were bandits. You may not have realized that. Mexican bandits, mostly. Horse thieves and just regular thieves. We chased our share of them, Bloom and me. Along with the others, of course. Rogerson, Mayberry, Stimson, right into Mexico. Oh, yes, our share. We chased them right into Mexico, Mr. Bloom. Right into Mexico."
My father nodded, smiled, sipped on his Coke. Mr. Templeton hadn't heard a word he said.
"You have a nice-looking horse out there," my father said.
"You know about horses, then," he said and laughed again, popping gravelly sounds. "You've found a man who knows something about horses, haven't you, dear?"
"I think I have, Daddy," she said.
"That's good," he said, nodding. "That's very good."
The day passed in just this way. Mr. Templeton told stories of his days in the cavalry and laughed, and the conversation turned to religion and Jesus, a favorite topic of Mr. Templeton's, for it was his belief that the crucifixion was an especially dastardly act, seeing as how Pontius Pilate and Jesus had been roommates at Oxford. In this light, Pontius Pilate had really done the Lord dirty. No more mention was made of the marriage the rest of that afternoon. Mr. Templeton, in fact, seemed to forget why they were there at all. And as dusk came on, it was time to leave. The three of them stood, the men shook hands again, and they walked past the closed bedroom door and slowed there. Sandra looked at her father, who shook his head.
"Not a good day," he said. "Best not disturb her."
And so they left, the two of them, waving at the old man through the darkening light, and him waving back at them and pointing with a child's delight toward the starry sky. His Three Labors. Because it was a great metropolis full of hope, my parents moved to Birmingham, Alabama, where my father sought his fortune. Word of his great strength, intelligence, and perseverance had spread even this far, and yet his youth was such that my father knew he must perform many great labors before he assumed his rightful place. His first labor was to work as a veterinarian's assistant. As a veterinarian's assistant, his most important responsibility was to clean out the dog kennels and the cat cages. Every morning when he arrived, the cages and kennels would be nearly filled with feces. Some of it would lie on the paper he'd placed down the night before, but still more would be smeared on the walls and some of it on the very animals themselves. My father cleaned this mess up every morning and every evening. He did it until the cages shone, until you could have eaten a meal off the surface of the floor, so spotless and clean had he left it. But it would only take a few seconds for it to get soiled again, and this was the job's terrible Sisyphean frustration. A dog might look straight at you, just as you were locking him into his lovely, newly cleaned cage, and shit. His second labor was as a sales clerk in the lingerie section of a department store downtown called Smith's. The fact that he'd been stationed in lingerie seemed a cruel joke, and indeed he suffered greatly from the sassy comments he heard from the men in other departments, especially from the men in sportswear. But he persevered, and eventually won the trust of the women who regularly shopped at Smith's, and in fact came to be preferred to the women who worked with him. They valued his keen eye. But there was one woman who was never able to accept my father as a sales clerk. Her name was Muriel Rainwater. She had lived in Birmingham all her life, had two husbands, both dead, no children at all, and money beyond counting to get through before she passed on herself. She was almost 80 years old then, and, much like a tree, each year had seen her girth expand until she'd become monumental. Still, she was quite vain. While she didn't care to be much thinner than she was, she certainly wanted to look much thinner, and thus often visited the lingerie department at Smith's, searching for the latest in girdles. And so every month, Mrs. Rainwater marched down to Smith's and sat down at one of the large, overstuffed chairs provided for its customers, and without a word, merely nodded toward a clerk, and that clerk duly brought her the latest in girdle wear. But that clerk was never Edward Bloom. This was clearly a snub. But the truth was that Edward was not particularly fond of Mrs. Rainwater either. No one was. The way her feet smelled of mothballs, her hair like burnt fabric, and the way her arms shook when she pointed at something she wanted. But the fact that she insisted on not allowing him to serve her made her, to Edward, the most desirable customer in the store. he made it his goal to one day wait on Muriel Rainwater. To this end, he pirated the next shipment of girdles and hid them in a corner of the warehouse, where only he could find them. Mrs. Rainwater came in the very next day. She sat down in an overstuffed chair and pointed at one of the girls.
"You," she said, "bring me the girdle."
The girl grew flustered, for she feared Mrs. Rainwater.
"The girdle?" she said. "But none have arrived."
"Oh, yes, they have,"
Mrs. Rainwater said, her mouth wide and gaping like a cave.
"I know they have arrived. You," she said, pointing to another,
her arms sloshing like a water balloon.
"If she can't serve me, you can. Bring me the girdle."
This girl ran crying from the floor. The next girl fell to her knees before Mrs. Rainwater even said a word. Finally, no one was left to point at but my father. He stood at the far end of the showroom floor, tall and proud. She saw him, but pretended not to. She pretended he wasn't there at all.
"Can someone please help me?" she screamed. "I want to see the new girdle. Can someone please?"
My father crossed the showroom floor and stood before her.
"What do you want?" she said.
"Here to serve you, Mrs. Rainwater."
Mrs. Rainwater shook her head and stared at her feet. She looked like she wanted to spit.
"Men don't belong in this department," she cried.
"And yet," he said, "here I am, and I alone know where the new girdles are. I alone can help you."
"No,"
she said, shaking her head in disbelief, her big horse eyes plainly shocked.
"This can't be. I'd
be happy to get it for you, Mrs. Rainwater, more than happy."
"Fine, then,"
she said, little bits of spittle collecting at the corners of her mouth.
"Get me the girdle."
And so he did. Mrs. Rainwater stood. She waddled to the changing room, where the girdle rested on a stool. She slammed the door behind her. My father heard her grunt and groan and snap and tighten, and finally, some minutes later, she emerged. She was no longer Mrs. Rainwater. She had been completely transformed. The girdle had taken her, this whale of a woman, and turned her into beauty itself. She did have a bounteous breast and a rear end of some proportion, but her figure was all wavy and smooth rolls, and she even seemed younger and sweeter and certainly a happier woman than before. It was, indeed, a technological miracle. She looked at my father as though he were a god.
"This is it," she cried, her voice a melodious tune. "This is the girdle I've been waiting for all my life, and to think that you, I've been so unfair. Can you ever forgive me?"
Then she turned from him and faced a mirror, where she enthusiastically admired her new self.
"Oh, yes," she said. "Oh, my, yes. This is how I was meant to look. With this, I can probably get a new husband. I never thought girdles could come so far so quickly. But look at me. Just look."
She turned and gave my father an adoring glance.
"You'll go far here, young man," she said.
The third and last labor Edward Bloom performed had to do with a wild dog. After being speedily promoted from sales clerk to manager, my mother and father moved into a small white house across the street from the elementary school. They were only the second family to live in that house. It had been built by Amos Calloway 60 years before, and he and his wife had raised a family there, and the children had all moved away. Mrs. Calloway had died many years before, and when Mr. Calloway died, everyone in the neighborhood assumed one of their lovely children would move back there to live. But they didn't. The children had their own lives, rooted in distant towns and cities, and, after burying their father, promptly put the house on the market, which the Blooms felt lucky to have snatched up. But the Blooms weren't welcome. Not in Amos Calloway's house. Amos Calloway's association with the house he built was so strong that following his death, some in the neighborhood suggested that the structure be raised and a park built for the children there. Now that the Calloways had departed, maybe the house should go too. For some strange new couple to come in and live there was like... It was like two people trying to squeeze into Amos Calloway's coffin, his own body just freshly placed there. In short, nobody much liked the Blooms. My mother and father did what they could to change this. My mother took in stray cats, just as she learned Mrs. Calloway had done. My father continued to trim the frontage azaleas into the shapes of the alphabet, something Amos was locally famous for. All for nothing. On weekends, my mother and father worked out in the yard, just as their neighbors did. But it was as if they were invisible. And in a way, they were. In order to bear the absence of Amos Calloway and his family, the neighborhood had chosen to disregard the Blooms' presence. Until there came a day when the neighborhood was invaded by a pack of wild dogs. Who knows where they came from? 6, 8, some say 10. They tore through the trash cans at night and dug deep holes in the gardens. The velvety canvas of sleep was torn by their terrible howls and vicious snarls. Other dogs who dared to face them were found dead the next morning, or never found at all. Children were not allowed outside past dusk, and some of the men took to carrying guns with them everywhere they went. Finally, the town called in officials from the State Bureau of Animal Control, and on one bloody night, all the wild dogs were either killed or captured. All but one, that is. And he was the fiercest, most terrible dog of all. Pitch black, he blended with the night. It was said he was so stealthy, you wouldn't know he was even near you until he showed you his bright, shining teeth. And this dog was not merely wild. He was a crazed, lunatic dog with a seeming human capacity for rage and retribution. One family paid dearly when they installed an electric fence around their property. Watching out the window one night, they saw the dog walk into it. It was shocked and thrown back into the street, but essentially unharmed. After that, the dog toured the edge of this family's property almost exclusively, with the effect that, through the night at least, no one came in and no one went out. It was as though, instead of protection, the family had built a prison for themselves. At any time in his life, my father could have tamed the dog and led him back into the hills from whence he came. Such was his way with animals. And yet he didn't. Why? Because for once, he couldn't. The rigors of his new life had weakened him. It wasn't a reluctance to use the strengths and powers he was born with. He simply didn't seem to possess them anymore. And the marauding would have continued if fate hadn't nudged my father in the small of his back, urging him to leave the house one night and take a walk. The streets of Edgewood were empty, of course. Who dared brave these streets after the sun had gone down, knowing as they did that the Hell Dog, as he'd come to be known, was out there, somewhere. My father thought little of the dog, however. He wasn't the kind of man who structured his life around a canine peril. Or perhaps my father was the agent of some greater power. All we know for certain is this. He went for a walk one night and saved a child's life. The child, 3-year-old Jennifer Morgan, who lived just 2 doors down from the old Calloway place, as it was still called, had wandered out the kitchen door while her parents were working to unclog a toilet in the master bedroom. She'd heard so much about the dog outside that she could no longer resist. She had to go out and pet him. When my father saw her, she was walking toward the feral black presence, with a piece of bread in her hand, calling, "Here, doggie! Doggie, come here!" The Hell Dog was coming at a leisurely gait, unable to believe his luck. He had never eaten a little girl before, but he'd heard they were tasty. Better than little boys, anyway, and almost as good as chickens. The culinary ecstasy of the moment was interrupted, however, by Edward Bloom. He scooped the girl up in his arms and tossed the bread to the dog, who ignored it and kept coming.